Brandon.
Hello, Alan.
We made it for a Not a Thing podcast. Did you survive St. Patrick's Day?
I did. It was not that crazy. I just did a little cooking and just a little bit of drinking. I stuck to
Nice.
beer, no whiskey this time.
Yeah, I also played it kind of close to the vest and did I mean, I did have my Guinness Extra Stout at home, but there was corned beef and green beer at work. I was very surprised. It was kind of
Nice.
nice. Yeah, I mean, they had gotten the beer from, I think it was Tide House, so it wasn't bad. I mean, it's not like super wonderful, but it was nice to, have kind of a festive atmosphere at work.
I actually did a little experimentation with my cooking this year. I cooked one corned beef brisket the old-fashioned way, just boiling the crap out of it in a slow cooker. And then I did another one that where I baked it instead. And baking is the way to go. It is way better.
I could see that.
But the trick with that though is you do need to boil it just a little bit to leach out some of the salt. Otherwise it's way too salty. But I followed that step, so it turned out well.
Nice, nice. Yeah, we did a kind of stir-fried chard and vegetable thing, which with horseradish, which ended up being just about right. And then we actually did there was a hot link that we found. Yeah, it wasn't corned beef.
Got a corned beef hot link, huh?
But it was nice. It was good, kind of I mean, we were thinking we would do something non-traditional anyway. I mean, me and my rich Irish heritage, I'd kind of be different.
I have a reputation to maintain, so
You
I did the
do.
corned beef, cabbage, potatoes.
No, I've had it. It's awesome. Anyway, yeah, I'm glad you made it. I'm glad we made it. It's been good, although apparently we made it just to have our jobs taken away by robots. Bill Gates gave an interview last week where he said a bunch of things, but one of the more kind of inflammatory things he said was that in 20 years, a bunch of jobs are going to be done either by software, well, software and robots, essentially. And I don't know if that article specifically said like what jobs would be taken away, but it would essentially be anything that is repetitive, because that's what computers and robots are good at, kind of repetitive tasks. So, I mean, it could be like cashiers or a bunch of things. But the one that I had read, and I don't know if it was in the article we're going to link, it may have been in a different one, but I saw a thing that said cutting of hair would be done by robots. And I
Well,
thought that was
the
funny.
article that we are going to link has a link to another article from The Economist earlier this year that said that they were going to be possibly replacing accountants and pilots in the next 20 years.
Ugh. Well, right, accountant, you're assuming that everyone is completely above board about all of the accounting that does. We'll pour a 40 out for you, Ted, if they do bring robots to take your job. But I
I
think
feel like my job is safe because I make the robot's communication system work, so I'm still valuable for now.
it's probably right. I think pilots, you might want to wait just a little bit.
Yeah, based on recent events, probably.
Yeah, I don't know. I really do hope they find some more evidence about the Malaysian Airlines flight, only because it is so maddening that it's been a week and a half and there's just no idea where it's from. It's like, if you can do, like, turn off your transponder on your plane and cut communications, you can essentially disappear. You can disappear one of the biggest planes in the commercial fleet. It just seems a little crazy. So not really giving a lot of confidence in air travel right now. Robots are not.
Part of me kind of wants it never to be found. Not a large part of me, but a small part, just to have that mystery. Feels like the world is too known in some ways.
So are you pulling for kind of a Langoliers thing? Or
I'm thinking like Twilight Zone, where they woke up and there's some sort of event and they're back in the Jurassic period or something.
Yeah, that would work out.
And then we'll find the plane, but it'll be, you know, millions of years old, like fossilized.
Or it'll be on, what was it? It'll be what was that?
Unsolved Mysteries?
No, that's exactly right. I'm thinking of the ending of Battlestar Galactica, unfortunately. Oh. Yeah, anyway, let's move on. Robots. Robots, I think, are not going to take everybody's job. I think there is a lot of stuff that works, but I think there's a lot of stuff that doesn't. I mean, just thinking of cashiers and the kind of that self-checkout kind of line, I don't know how many times that self-checkout line has been either broken or otherwise doesn't work for me. Like, I just found out this week that you can't buy alcohol in the self-checkout line.
Nope, not anymore.
Because they don't check your ID in the self-checkout line. So there's, you know, I don't think robots are going to take over everything kind of just yet. I mean,
not till they improve robots.
Yeah. Well, it's not even necessarily robots that are there. I mean, it's even just the software for the self-checkout. I mean, just using that as the example, it's just not good. I mean, it fidgets if you don't put the item in on the thing on the side, because it doesn't weigh it, so it doesn't know you put it there. It's like, I have to put it in this kind of weird staging area and then put it back into my cart, which is fine if it's like small groceries or whatever. But I was just at Home Depot and I was buying rocks for the yard. We're lining the pathway or whatever. So I have these four 30-pound bags of rocks and I have to pick them up out of the cart onto the scanner and then onto the staging area and then back onto the cart. It's just silly. Now, if the robot picked it up for me,
If you can send a robot to go shopping for you, I still would not support it, because that's a slippery slope and robots are dangerous. Fear the singularity.
Yeah, I think the message of the show still rings true about robots kind of in general. No. Don't take my jobs, robots. But in the there is the specific exception that we still kind of quibble about self-driving cars, and Volvo this last week also released the tests of a new system to add magnets to roads, and all of the self-driving cars that are out right now. Well, I mean, it's really just the Google self-driving car, as far as I know, which does analysis using radar to find things that are around it, but then also optical recognition of like road markers and lane markers and curbs and stuff like that. So what the Volvo thing was, is it's to add magnets to roads that can be covered with stuff like leaves, dirt, mud, snow, whatever, just something that would obscure the road. So you can't use kind of visual detection to figure out where the edges of the road are and stuff. And it was really interesting how they put it together. I was kind of surprised that it worked, because I had seen stuff about putting magnets in a road, and it seems like it'd be trivial to just like keep following where the magnets are. But they made a good point that when you're driving at 90 miles an hour, which you might do
in a Volvo.
Well, maybe not in a like the big kind of boxy station wagon-y Volvos, but the new ones, like the C70, I think is what it is. It's kind of sporty. I could see that going above 70 miles an hour. But then maybe not if a robot's driving it. I don't know. Anyway, in order to detect that there are magnets in the road, the way that they were doing it, they were essentially putting the magnets some distance apart, kind of along the lane marker, for example. And then in order for it to be able to detect that at speed, they put an array of sensors kind of underneath the body of the car and in the front, so it could track as it was going, you know, at very high speed. And they tested it all the way up to like 90 miles an hour, and it works. But it was something like $10,000 to add that to the car.
Well, it was $24,000 per kilometer to get that system installed.
On the roads, right.
On the roads, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
So it'd be a lot of money invested there. I'm not sure that's the way things are going to shake out.
Yeah, I do like the idea of magnets, because magnets are awesome.
Magnets, bitch.
Right, so it does sound like a good way to do it, because the upside was that you could essentially drill a hole into the road surface, whatever it is. It'll even work on dirt, and then you drop a magnet in, and that's it. And it works whether that surface is obscured or not, and that's kind of attractive, because otherwise, if you are doing something, you know, visual, you have to, you know, continuously clear that road. Otherwise, the robot will not be able to drive on it. And so it's kind of a novel way to do it, but it does sound prohibitively expensive. So maybe not a thing yet. I still think there are ways to do it. Maybe not magnets. They got to think of something else. They should just use radioactive isotopes.
Oh, yeah. Let's irradiate the rest of the country. That sounds like a great idea.
They could just use, you know, a little bit of tritium or something in the road paint.
Right.
Easy. Not a
problem. You don't have to worry about leaching of chemicals into... No, it'll be fine.
Oh, you just hate the future.
Kinda. I don't hate it, I fear it.
Oh, that's a very good distinction. Well, if there's something to fear, it's actually there's two things to fear, I think, in this article. There was a story out that, and this came out a while ago, that it was probably Monsanto, but it may have been another kind of crazy agribusiness company, but somebody had figured out a way to genetically engineer plants so they would be insect resistant. And it wouldn't be that they would be resistant to, like, you know, an insect chomping on it or whatever. It would actually manufacture bioengineer pesticide. And what was crazy about this story, I mean, so that's, I mean, that aspect of it is nuts, right? You're essentially making a thing which kills small animals. How are you doing that such that it doesn't kill, like, large animals, like people? But anyway, if you can get past that, the thing that was marvelous was that there's a worm that evolved in even just the short amount of time that they've had it out, kind of testing it in whatever situation they had it testing. There's a worm that's evolved to like that pesticide, and it actually will seek out the plants that have that pesticide. So it's essentially destroying the bioengineered plants. As a, you know, it's evolved as a result of human meddling.
Well, as the great Jeff Goldblum once told us, nature finds a way.
Oh, I was worried that you were going to go with what was that M. Night Shyamalan movie with the bees killing everybody?
The Happening?
Yes.
Yeah, why would you bring that up?
It's essentially nature is reacting or overreacting to kind of human meddling with genetics and stuff, which I think is it's kind of poetic in one sense and also kind of scary. So I don't know. I think a significant amount of this kind of genetic engineering for plants is not a thing. I feel like the kind of grooming of plants and stuff for as a food is it's pretty good. Like, we don't need to mess with it at the genetic level to get it where it's going. But I don't know. Who am I to say that? I like, you know, juicy apples and stuff like that too. And I'm not about to you know, raise my own like pigs and stuff, even though I love bacon.
Here's the problem. I wouldn't mind having a pet pig because they're adorable, but also I would want to eat it because bacon is delicious, which is why I don't have a pet pig.
It just, you know, one day if the cuteness level kind of drops below the hunger level rising, you have an issue, right? It's a very delicate balance, life. Although was nice. I mean, I want to give another shout out to the Cosmos show. This week it was Evolution, and it talked about how there's like artificial selection that people can do, and that's what kind of the in the example was, that's what different breeds of dogs kind of comes from. And there's the natural selection of just kind of the you know, any little mutation that and how that is nurtured by the environment at large. And so it was nice to have that kind of as a backdrop for this story anyway.
Yeah, it's kind of one versus the other, natural selection versus, the other selection.
Well, but it also shows that, you know, given a long enough timeline, nature will kind of adapt to that unnatural selection, as it were, and nurture those advantages, or the things that would make it advantageous in that kind of system too. And it's not necessary. I don't know. It doesn't. I like how it doesn't have kind of a value judgment about like which is better or anything like that. I mean, I think given a long enough timeline, nature's gonna win. Yeah, they didn't really, they didn't hint at that as much as I thought they would. There were a couple kind of points where it was like, yeah, humans, see where we are on this like huge tree, we're this one little thing. And then there was the bit about the Hall of Extinctions, and it's like, oh, there's this hallway, we're not gonna go there, that's for another
Yeah.
time.
No, I'm definitely still liking that program. I think it's an important thing for people to see.
And it's a pretty good palate cleanser after Walking Dead, if you're into that show too. That was kind of brutal this week. I won't go into it.
I did hear what happened, but I haven't been watching for a while, so
Okay.
I can understand. Well,
kind of in that in that cosmos kind of super spacey way, there was some really big space news this week. Really big, actually, the Big Bang big space news. I guess astronomers and scientists have figured out or found evidence that kind of support the inflationary theory of the birth of the universe, the Big Bang theory, for lack of a better term. I really don't want to refer to that show. but yes, the whole expansionist universe kind of thing. And it's kind of this long and convoluted kind of bit of the article about how it was defined and found. Essentially, there's background radiation from the Big Bang, and the way they describe it is after the Big Bang, which is, you know, all particles in the universe being in a thing that's like the size of an atom. And then exploding, you can imagine that being, you know, very hot. This kind of like this great expenditure of energy. And so the theory, or one of the components of the theory, is that as it's cooling down, it's spreading out. And so they're going to be kind of this uniform cooling down of everything. And in addition to that cooling down, it's not actually going to be uniform. It will be, there will be waves in that kind of heat. So at different kind of distances or whatever, there would be pockets of heat and pockets of cold, because that's how kind of waves work. The shock wave of the Big Bang would kind of ripple through. And it's working off two theories. So one, the background radiation of the Big Bang, the leftover background radiation. And the second one is that there are waves in gravity. That gravity's not like a constant, or it is a constant thing, but there can be that it travels in kind of a wave form and has properties of that. And it's a little dense. And I remember, I know thinking about it now, it's like it's kind of difficult to grasp, but one of the best explanations of this was one that I'd found ages ago, and I'm really going to try and dig it up because it's one of the better explanations for how gravity is shown. So gravity obviously is kind of 3D and planets, and it sort of makes sense. The way that this article made it make sense was if you treat the universe as flat, as just a sheet of cloth, for example, the way that gravity works is if you take an object like a ball, and you put it on that cloth, it's going to, if the cloth is suspended, it's going to leave a dip where the ball is. And so if you roll a smaller ball past it, it will curve towards the dip, because, you know, it wants to fall down into the space. And so if you turn this into 3D, that's what gravity is. Essentially, big things exert kind of this, not a downward force, but they exert this kind of tension in space-time, and then that's why things are drawn to it. It's really, I thought it was a great example for how to do it. And then, you know, their example for a black hole is you're essentially pulling down on that sheet as hard as possible. So like nothing goes past it. Anyway, the thing with gravity waves is if you drop the ball into the sheet, and it will bounce. It will kind of bounce the sheet depending on how tight it is and how big the ball is. And so those waves are what scientists are trying to detect. Everyone still with me?
Yeah.
I kind of kind of went off the deep end. I really like this bit of kind of astrophysics and stuff. I didn't know that I was a super astrophysics geek until this set of articles came up about the background radiation and the Big Bang and stuff. And it's really fascinating to me.
Heavy stuff, man.
Yeah, gravity is pretty neat. The thing about gravity waves and the way they would detect it was this. They wanted to build this huge structure in space. I don't know if they ever actually got to do it, but they've built things like this on Earth. And what it essentially is these two very long, rods of a material that don't, or they're resistant to contraction and expansion due to heat. So you want them to be as uniform as possible. And then what you do is you put really, really precise sensors around the edges, so you can measure essentially how long the things are at all times. And so it's a known thing that there are tidal forces caused by the moon and stuff like that. And so what you would do is you would measure these things, and you'd constantly measure them, and you have them at right angles to each other. And if gravity waves exist, you would see a contraction and expansion of it based on gravity. And it would occur not at the same time, but kind of at a delay because they're at a right angle. I lost everybody, huh? The Not a Thing podcast ended on March 18th. Well,
I don't know about how smooth of a transition this is going to be, but did you know that you can make a shot glass out of a cookie?
we're going to leave the world of gravity waves and the Big Bang, which I think are great. Great discoveries. It's good that science is still occurring, despite the fact that we don't have space shuttles and stuff like that. But keep looking to the stars, everybody.
NASA funding, it should be a thing. But in the meantime, shot glass cookies.
Yeah, apparently the guy that invented Cronuts, the croissant donut, also is selling out of his New York bakery. Shot glass cookies. And so it's a cookie that is roughly shaped like a shot glass, and they fill it with milk, and you can buy one, and then they'll pour a little bit of milk in it, and you sip the milk out of it, and then you can eat the cookie. It's kind of, instead of dipping the chocolate chip cookie in milk, you're pouring the milk into the cookie. And it sounds really interesting until you actually try to do it, because as anyone who has dipped a chocolate chip cookie into milk knows, it will become amazingly soggy very quickly. And so there's all these different ways to essentially shellac the inside of it to reinforce it so the milk doesn't eat away the cookie too quickly. The one that I'm particularly fond of is you essentially pour chocolate on the inside of the cookie to make a kind of a chocolate shell inside that you pour the milk into. That's kind of fun. We'll link to, I think it's an instructable on how to do it. The Not a Thing podcast does not confirm or deny the awesomeness of these cookies, but they do sound pretty good.
We can't give you instructions on how to test for gravitational waves, but we can get you instructions of how to make a cookie shot glass.
It's pretty much the next best thing. And we'll move into we'll move into movie territory. There were the end of the Cinequest Film Festival was this last weekend, and I remember talking about it on the show last week. The show or the movie that I was really most excited about. But before I get to that one, there was one movie that I missed in the list from 2 weeks ago called, it was called Eternity the movie. I don't know, the movie part of it is kind of silly, but it was a joking kind of look at a fake R&B band from the 80s called Eternity. And so it was done as a, not a biopic exactly, but just kind of following the band members as they their rise and fall of their kind of 80s band. And it had all the right things, right? It had a saxophone playing guy, it had mullets, it had a really big or jackets with really big shoulder pads. It was everything. It was pretty funny. And what was, I thought, really funny was that when we went to downtown San Jose to kind of hang out before the movie, we walked into one of the bars that's downtown, 55 South First. And we're sitting there getting drinks, and they start setting up kind of an event on the side of the bar, and they had us all move over to one side. And it's like, okay, fine, whatever. I don't know what they're doing over there. But it was the premiere party for the movie. And so they had the cast and the filmmakers in. So there are people that are dressing up in like 80s clothes, you know, in downtown San Jose. It was silly. It was, you know, it's an experience. But the movie that I was most excited about was a remake of Unforgiven, the Clint Eastwood, just kind of epic Western, done as a samurai film. And I think this was kind of purposely done to bookend the changing of the samurai film, The Seven Samurai, into The Magnificent Seven. And this was a nice kind of reversal on that, especially for, you know, one of my favorite Westerns. So it was great. And I think you talked about it, just how much rage there was in the original Unforgiven. And yeah, it carries over. It is hardcore. I mean, you can imagine, it was very similar kind of in look and feel to Unforgiven as a Western, because it's kind of a similar time frame in Japan. It's the end of the Shogun era and the end of the samurais. The emperor has essentially squashed them all. So guns are just starting in Japan, which it fits kind of pretty well, but everyone still has swords. And swords make everything so brutal. So, it was great. It was well done. Ken Watanabe was actually the main character.
Oh, he's good.
Yeah. So I liked that a lot. That was really worth watching. It didn't have the line that I... one of the lines that I really remember from the film, there are two, and neither were there. And I don't know if it was just because of the translation that it doesn't come across the same, but the line about, where Clint Eastwood's character says, it's like, it's a hell of a thing killing a man. You take away, everything he has and everything he's ever gonna have. That line kind of sticks with me, and I don't remember there being kind of an equivalent. And then, you know, the final kind of piece in the film where he's, he's essentially, spoiler alert, like killed everyone that was bad. And, it's something like, what is it? And if you, you know, I'll kill all of you sons of bitches too, or something to that effect. It was just this, like, you know, that's the last line in the film. And they went kind of a different tack for the Japanese version to end it. It was a lot more kind of tragic feeling, and less, wow, that was the most crazy, like, action sequence I've ever seen. So I think it works. It still works tonally, because it does feel very, it feels very kind of somber and sad, and I think that fits for the main character just as well in the samurai version of it. But it so it's not a you know shot for shot remake or anything. Although the killing of the guy in the outhouse felt almost the same. Like, there were a lot of similar shots, and it is just as brutal. It is awful. It's great. It's great. It's a great film.
I will be checking that out when it becomes available for wide release.
We also did see a couple other movies at the end of the weekend. What did we see? We saw Bill Plimpton, who he does Plimptoons, PlyMptoons, and he does those are kind of the short, like 5-minute cartoons, and I would always see them at Spike and Mike's Sick and Twisted Festival of Animation, because they were always kind of on the edge of like dirty, but just very strange. It has this style, like every frame is individually drawn. So it was the kind of wiggly line thing that Dr. Katz and Home Movies did, but it's all traditional animation. And he has a movie that was out called Cheatin', and that was this Saturday. And then on Friday, we watched The Hands of Orlok, which is a kind of horror film. This pianist is in this train accident, and then he's given the hands of a... his hands are destroyed. He's given the hands of a serial killer, and he thinks that those hands are causing him to, you know, act violently and stuff. And
so it's like the Simpsons Treehouse of Horror, where Homer gets the wig.
Right.
Or gets the hair from Snake.
Exactly. But it was done, it's a silent film, and they had the Wurlitzer organ going, and because he's a concert pianist in the film, they had a concert pianist doing the piano in addition, and there was a guy who was operating a theremin in the meantime to do kind of any of the ghost effects and stuff, which I thought was great. I still think watching a silent movie with the live soundtrack is really worth doing. If you can get access to it, you should absolutely do it.
And if you can't do that, then you should go see the movie that I saw this weekend, the Lego Movie.
So is everything awesome?
Everything is awesome. It was like, almost as good as a Pixar movie, but without like being overly long like a Pixar movie sometimes can be. I think it clocked in at like under 2 hours.
Okay.
But it was it was a lot of fun. It was very, it didn't feel like a commercial. It felt like a celebration of a toy that many people have loved growing up.
Yeah, and it sounded like it was not, it was just about Lego. It wasn't like following a particular, like, storyline of toys or whatever. Because
if anything, it'd be like it was kind of like The Matrix. That's the closest closest comparison I can make.
Wow, that is
like The Matrix, kind of.
That's hefty. That's
just as far as story structure.
Okay,
but it was directed by the same people who did 21 Jump Street.
Oh, okay.
The same director duo. Phil Lord and Christopher Miller. And it had a lot of great voice actors like Chris Pratt, Will Ferrell, Will Arnett as Batman, Nick Offerman as a pirate robot.
Oh, beauty.
And Liam Neeson as a bad cop was great. He played good cop and bad cop. He's a split personality.
Oh, that's great.
But it also, I mean, it was funny. It was fun. The story moved along really quickly. But it also had some emotional tug to it at the end.
Oh, wow.
It gets my full recommendation.
And we're not talking like Toy Story 3 level, right?
No. It was not Schindler's Toy Box.
Or even Toy Story 2. I mean, the whole thing with Jesse, with the Sarah McLachlan song going. Oh, God.
No, I don't know. It was... I don't want to ruin... I don't want to spoil it.
Sure.
But it had some emotional resonance.
Oh, good. I mean, I am and have been a fan of Lego. I remember the first thing I built, I don't remember it being a kit ever. Because I remember just having this huge box of like a bunch of Legos that were from different things. There were space ones, and there was like a playset that I think at one point was either an ambulance or some like kind of emergency vehicle, because it had all the little translucent ones that could be used as the lights on top of the car or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I had, you know, that you have those flat, the big flat pieces, the pieces that you would just use as the foundations for buildings or whatever. And I remember having one that had kind of a fake moonscape on it. It had little, like, plastic craters. And so I remember making, like, a little, like, lunar lander on it. And then I would make a spaceship that would, like, attack the lunar lander. I don't know why I thought that, you know, aliens would want to shoot things landing on the moon. But, you know... You know, when you're young, your mind goes off in all sorts of fun directions.
I mean, Legos were definitely a large part of my childhood. I spent a lot of time at a huge box of Legos that I played with. And the one thing going into this movie I was looking for was, like, don't exploit my childhood, please.
Uh-huh.
And it didn't feel that way at all. It felt much more celebratory.
Cool.
Very on note.
Awesome. That's good. That's good. I'm glad.
Everything is awesome. We'll see how I feel about it in a few days when that song is still stuck in my head. But
yeah, there have been enough people kind of humming it or singing parts of it or just saying that around work that it's definitely entering the cultural zeitgeist, as it were. It's a thing. Well, we will, that's a good point to kind of, land the dismount, right?
Yeah. After that wonderful transition we had to the cookie shot glasses, I think this is as good as we're going to get.
Well, I'm going to go, probably have a thing in a shot glass, maybe not a cookie shot glass.
I might just go have a cookie. I think I've still got some Girl Scout cookies kicking around here somewhere.
Ooh. Yeah, no matter how you feel about Girl Scout cookies, those things are here to stay. Or rather, go away very quickly and then come back. Anyway, I will talk to you next week, Brendan.
Till next time, Alan.